So in our Akdama to Kalik, which probably take a little bit more just to finish off, but then we'll start calling it straight. We're discussing attitudes towards, and that's kind of the bigger theme, attitude towards Agarata. And I was particularly trying to focus in on the view of the Rambam and of the... thank you. Of the Rambam and of the Ramban. So, of course, in the Rambam, this is exactly the introduction in Chelek, which is mostly famous as an introduction for Ikare Emuna, and very critical for that, but also has a very important statement of the Rambam about three perspectives on Divrei Chazal and Agadata, as well the three camps that he identifies that I want to just discuss if we have a few minutes. If not today, then hopefully when we finish this up the next time. But before I do that, I wanted to speak just a little bit historically out of order about the very famous view of the Ramban, which I alluded to, and some people didn't seem to be so aware of what I was talking about. So in the Bikuach, the famous disputation in Barcelona in 1263, in the presence of the King of Spain, Aragon, King James I, so there was this this exchange between Pablo Christiani, as he's sometimes called, and Ramban. And of course, there is, I'm not going to go into all the historical aspects of the issue. We have to speak a little bit about it. But there's a lot of controversy about, the text of the Bikuach that we have, from the Ramban, and whether or not it's exactly, whether it presents fully, what took place, Lekula or Lechumra. There are all sorts of different versions of it, and also different perspectives on it. But, of course, we're going to use the text that we have. But one of the issues that came up was whether or not it was legitimate for people to be citing or invoking Divrei Agada in the context of a disputation. Meaning, was it to be taken literally, and was it to be taken as historically factual, and was it to be taken as halachically, or at least hashkafically, authoritative? Those are three different issues, and the overlap of those three is an important, and the distinction between them also is an important issue as well. So what's interesting, as many have noted, is that in a certain sense, this marked a certain turning point in the phenomenon of using Divrei Chazal, in these contexts. Because previous to this disputation, mostly, the issues centered around, how literal we should be taking Divrei Chazal and Divrei Medrash, especially as it relates to either historical events or the nature of the Ribono Shel Olam. And that's metaphysical issues, and especially issues connected to describing the essence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, issues of anthropomorphism, and in previous even disputes among Jews and Christians, the Medrash was sometimes quoted as a way of trying to undermine Jewish credibility, to embarrass Jewish thinkers. What kind of religion is it that speaks about the Ribono Shel Olam wearing tefillin, describes, physically, his features and so on. And of course, we understand that, those kind of midrashim are, of course, intended to be not literal, but symbolic. They represent the relationship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael, or different tchunos of the Ribono Shel Olam. But we'll leave that for later. But these kind of... literal, when you take them literally, absurdities or a kind of, crude, description was used to try to undermine the authenticity of Yahadus as a religion. So, for example, 200 years earlier, and again, another famous Mishumad, Peter Alfonsi, you know, kind of compiled this whole list of midrashim that were embarrassing, or seemingly embarrassing, to the Rabbanu Shel Olam. The 13th century development in the time of the Ramban marked a bit of a turning point in that instead of citing a medrash as evidence of the crudeness of the Jewish religion and therefore its obvious inauthenticity, the medrash was assumed to be, you know, authentic and a legitimate source, you know, for the purpose of marshaling or mobilizing evidence on behalf of Christian claims of, you know, especially the claim that, you know, the Messiah, that Mashiach had already come, you know, in the figure of their expanded notion of the deity. So this, of course, is a totally different kind of a question. That's instead of saying, instead of being, you know, invoked, you know, to ridicule, it was now being invoked to, you know, internally undermine, you know, from a historical point of view, or to provide support and succor, you know, to the adversarial, you know, reconstruction of history and of theology. So the ability to pivot, you know, on this kind of an issue was itself very challenging. Because again, previously, you know, Jewish authorities had understood that they needed to, you know, develop a strategy, you know, for, on the one hand, maintaining reverence for Chazal, which is a pivotal linchpin kind of a notion, as we know, but at the same time, you know, trying to, you know, temper that, you know, with adopting, you know, a totally literal view, you know, where that was going to be undermining. But all of a sudden, you know, find yourself in a position, you know, where your own texts are being used against you is a different matter entirely. Again, especially in the you know, historical background of, you know, what had just previously happened, in which there was like a very intense focus on, again, this previous challenge in the context of the Maimonidean controversy, right? The battle over the books of the Rambam, which stirred, you know, controversy in Spain and as well in Provence, you know, and the burning of books that took place in that context. So part of that, you know, focused on the question of crass materialism or anthropomorphism, and, you know, the Rishonim took different stands on that issue. And what emerged, again, was mostly a restatement, though, notwithstanding whatever, you know, alterations have to be made in terms of how we look at these things, but a very strong statement about the obvious reverence that is required from a Hashkafic point of view, etc., when it comes to Chazal. So the idea that it wasn't necessarily literal, that there's a difference between halacha and medrash, it's not mishpat echad yalachem, that, you know, the history, you know, sometimes outlined in medrash and, isn't always necessarily binding, that the notion that in parshanut, you don't have the same notion of mishpat echad yalachem, of uniformity, as you do in Hashkafa in general, these are some of the things that emerged from, you know, very extensive discussions, you know, in the aftermath of the Maimonidean controversy. And, you know, we keep regurgitating these issues, you know, adli amenu anu, and that's totally fine. You know, all these questions keep coming back, and sometimes are new wrinkles and so on and so forth. In this context, the Ramban himself was known as someone, again, who took a very, you know, small c conservative posture, being somebody who was very defensive about, you know, the, you know, validity and authenticity and the reverence that is required for Divrei Chazal. And the Ramban was even somewhat critical, certainly of the Rambam. Again, we're not going to discuss all the Maimonidean controversy right now, but of course the Ramban has a famous letter, you know, which begins with Terem Enev Ani Shogeg, right, his care you know, not to be critical of the Rambam, but that certainly students of the Rambam, you know, who went too far in allegorizing, you know, in the area of halacha and other things. But the Ramban, most of this was known as a, as I say, as a very traditional, you know, and conservative with a small c, thinker. Again, in the, you know, in the 1240s, the Bikuach of Rabbi Chiel Paris and Nicholas Donin, 23 years earlier than the Ramban's Bikuach itself. So the reliability of the Medrash in terms of anthropomorphism, again, was a major issue, where Rabbi Yechiel, one of the Bali Tosas, said that, you know, you could reject the anthropomorphic Midrashim, or they weren't to be understood literally, and so on. Again, all this was part of the attack to discredit the Talmud, and this, of course, was the burning of the Talmud episode. So, you know, basically the tactic of feigning accreditation for the Medrash and then using it, you know, to show what the Talmud really was, that was really the context for the previous challenges. And as I say, the invoking of the Gaonim in these circumstances, Rav Sadia Gaon in particular, Rav Hai Gaon, Rav Shrira Gaon, if you look at Otsar Gaonim, various volumes, you'll see some of these, the one in Brachos, page 91, volume 4, 59 through 60, the Hakdama of Rav Shmuel HaNagid in his... you know, his famous Hakdama de Shas, even the, you know, the Kuzari, book 3, you know, chapter 73, famous discussion there about, you know, agadatas that are against the, you know, rational thought, you know, do not in any way undermine the value of the total Talmud, and they are meant to be understood in a more symbolic way, etc. The Rambam's view itself, as I said, we'll get back to, because I want to coordinate that with the three kitos that he identifies in his Hakdama d'Chelek. But of course, it's a little bit, you know, like many things in the Rambam, a little bit complex. On the one hand, the Rambam, you know, in numerous places, is open to dismissing, you know, the literal character of the Medrash, obviously. And at the same time, if you look at, you know, at the Rambam in Mor Nebuchim, never mind elsewhere, you know, Medrash is clearly integrated into his presentations, you know, as default being both authoritative and relevant. And of course, that works in very nicely with the three perspectives that he outlines in the beginning of Chelek. But we'll talk a little more about that in Hakdama to Mor Nebuchim. The Rambam discusses or mentions, you know that he, you know, was thinking of writing a Perush on Medrash, which is fascinating. It would have been fascinating, even more fascinating, if he had done it. You know, in some famous passages, Book 3, you know, Chapter 45, and that's, you know, towards the end when he's in the Tamei Mitzvos parts. So he talks about, you know, Medrash being, you know, poetical, you know, literary conceits, things of that sort. But again, that's, you know, in some wordplay Midrashim. Mostly, the Rambam wants you to know that there's a difference between halacha and medrash, that medrash isn't specifically literal. In the Hakdama to Mishneh Torah, again, the Rambam rejects the idea of wholesale or just, you know, unjustified rejection of medrash. In Hilchos Melachim, Perek Beis, he also says that you can't rely on medrash in order to piece together a, you know, a clear view of the sequence of Yemos HaMashiach, but that's because he thinks that is intentionally, you know, obscure. Again, if you take any of these, and the real point I'm trying to make is if you take any of these statements out of context, you know, they sound much more significant than they are. When you look at them all together, you know, the picture that emerges is that the Rambam had a very dialectical view of Medrash. He felt that it was, you know, part of Hashkafa, that it was, you know, default, you know, accepted and authoritative. But of course, that doesn't mean literal. And, you know, when it clashed with, you know, philosophical principles, other halachic principles, etc. So he felt that, you know, that was even more reason, right, to treat it, you know, in a more flexible way. But this, I'd say, is consistent with the worldview of the Gaonim and Chachmei Sfarad in general. I mentioned the Kuzari and others, and is not really particularly surprising. Much more relevant is that, according to the Rambam, the level of reverence and the default assumption that this is part, you know, these are texts that are important, even in some cases authoritative, that conclusion is a far more important one, you know, than isolating specific, you know, comments here or there where the Rambam is dismissive of a particular medrash or two or three. Okay. But the Ramban, as I say, certainly had this history going into the Vikuach of somebody who was very defensive of and very much somebody who integrated Medrash into his worldview. We know that the Ramban does not hesitate to provide alternatives to the Medrash in his Perush on the Torah. He does that all the time, every page practically. But that, you know, doesn't, you don't get the impression in the Ramban that that's because he's dismissive in any way of Medrash. It's part of the Ramban's perspective that, you know, Shivim Panim LaTorah, and you know, just as he, you know, reveres Rashi and is more ambivalent, but obviously also very respectful of the Ibn Ezra, you know, and yet not reluctant or reticent, you know, to propose his own views in the matter of Parshanot. You know, so the Medrash is part of that. But, you know, again, side by side with his independence and his, unhesitating posture, you know, to make his own suggestions, is certainly, the default is that the worldview of the Medrash is part and parcel and is a linchpin in our understanding of the world of Hashkafa, of the world of Torah, both historically and especially in terms of values. And therefore his comments in the Vikuach stirred tremendous controversy because, because they came from the Ramban, and the Ramban was the Ramban, right? Don't need to say anything. He was the Ramban even then, you know, not just later. Moreover, because he used language which probably is even stronger than previous language had been used in terms of believing the Medrash, and in terms of, you know, rationality, you know, being the criterion for the rejection of certain Midrashim. And of course the big question is, did he mean what he said, or, you know, in the strength of these words, were the pressures, meaning the idea that, you know, Medrash was being invoked as a theological foundation to attack, you know, Yesodos Emuna of Yadus, did that impact in any way, you know, his formulation? This is a big controversy among, you know, historians and Balei Halacha and, Ramban interpreters, you know, from that point on. I'll just read you what he says, and then I'll tell you what I really think. So he talks about the problem was, I say, the question, the real thorny question of, when, you know, Mashiach took place, at what point in history, which has enormous implications in debating, you know, the other religion, or that other religion. He says, Chazar Fry Paul, right? V'ton ki v'talmud amru shekvar bahamash. This is right in the beginning of the Vikuach. I'm reading from the Chevel edition. Ki b'talmud amru shekvar b'mashiach. I'm going to switch over in a few minutes. V'hevi osa agada shebemedrash echa. Bahu gavra, right? And he quotes the medrash here. So va'an va'om. It sounds in that medrash like that at the time of the churban, Mashiach was born. Va'an va'omar. This is a oschaf in the right in the beginning here. Va'an va'omar. Eini ma'amin b'hagada zu klal. Aval raya hiladvari. Okay. Az za'ak osa ha'ish. right? V'amar ru'u shehu makhish b'svarim shelohem. Like, look, the Jews are denying their own books, their own texts, their own authoritative texts. Amarti be'emet she'ini ma'amin shenolan ha-mashiach b'yom ha-chorban. V'hagod azos, now if you notice carefully, it's, there's multiple options. O she'ina kasher amarta. I'm sorry, o she'ina emes. I said, I skipped a line. It's an important line to skip. O she'ina emes. That's the controversial one. O she'yesh la perush acher. Aval akabelosa kipshuta kasher marta kiraya hili. Right, so he's saying, A, you know, I don't necessarily believe it, or there's another meaning, or three, even if you accept it, still, you know, I'm going to turn it against you. Very ambitious. We're not going to go into that part of it. And then, of course, back and forth. Amarti lo atabocher kiminagechem. Lanos b'mirma b'dinim, v'alkaponim eneschem b'kan. Lo amru chachamim shaba, aval amru shenolad, kayom shenolad Moshe Rabbeinu, lo ba, v'lo yagoel, aval k'shaba l'paro b'mitzvaso shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'amru lo ko amar Hashem, shalach ami, az ba, v'chein ha-mashiach, k'she yavo l'apifyor, v'yomru lo b'mitzvas hu elokim shalach ami, az yeba, v'ad hayom lo ba, v'gam einenu mashiach klal, כי דבר המלך ביום שנולד לא היה מלך ולא משיח. אבל כשמושכו שמואל היה משיח. Now you get the basic idea. טענו סו האיש הנה פרשה סיני יסקל עבדי. Of course that's the whole Yeshaya controversy. אמרתי לו כפי המשמעות האמיתי. Right? אינו מדברס על הבאם ישראל בכללם. That's not about the משיח. And so the discussion goes. I'm turning the page a little bit because then he elaborates on his view about this medrash or medrash. Kamti va'omar, shimu amim kulam, fry Paul sha'alani, im kvar ba mashiach, shedibru bo hanavim, v'amarti shalo ba, v'hevi sefer agada, sh'amar bo, ki b'yom shachar beis hamikdash, bo b'yom nolad, v'amarti ani, she'eni ma'amin baze, elahu raya ledvari, v'ata ani afaresh lachem, lo ma'amarti she'eni ma'amin baze. Deu ki anachnu yesh lanu gimel minim shel svarim. Ha'echad hu ha-biblia, okay, that's the Bible, by the way. V'kulanu ma'minim bo emuna shleima. Everything in the Bible is sacrosanct, right? Emuna shleima. Hasheni hu anikra Talmud, hu perush lemitzas haTorah, ki b'tor yesh tarieg mitzvos. The Ein Ba'achas Shalom is Parsha B'Talmud. Carefully, I have to read this carefully. V'anachnu Mamidim Bo B'Perush HaMitzvos. Now, when it comes to the Halacha, the Talmud is authoritative completely. There's no room to, you know, dispute its authority or its literariness either. Od Yeshlanu Sefer Shlishi HaNikra Medrash Rotzalomar. I know what that is. Sermons, right? Sermonish, whatever. Sermons. Kamosh im yamod hegmon v'yasa sermon v'echad min hashomim haya tov beinav v'kosvo. Right? Go to drasha. V'zeh sefer. Right? Right. Misha yamin bo tov u'misha lo yamin bo lo yazik v'yesh lanu chachamim shekosvu shemashiach lo. Ivaled ad es korob lizmana kates shavola hotzienu min agolus. Okay, in any memin mamin bazar sefer b'mashamar shenolim miyom akurban v'od anu korin also sefer hagada rotsa lomar ras yonamenito rotsa lomar she'enin el advarim she'adam magid lechabero. אבל אני מקבל אותה הגדה כפשוטה, כמו שאתם חפצים בה, בפני שיראי מפורשת, שאין ישו שלכם משיח כאשר אמרתי לכם. Okay. And then he says, people don't usually do it for 1,000 years, and so on, and so forth. So these statements about, you know, the tripartite, I guess, Jewish text, you know, the Bible, the... you know, halachic part of Chazal and the Medrash, you know, this became very famous. The Ramban here certainly seems to be suggesting that when it comes to Medrash, you can take it or leave it. You can decide you don't believe it if you think it's, you know, irrational. And that either way, it's not authoritative. What many people have pointed out, though, is that, of course, you know, Bo Bizman, and you know, practically Toch Kedei Dibur, is saying that he doesn't believe, you know, in this particular medrash. He also cites the possibility that A, it has a different interpretation. B, the context in which he rejects it is one in which he also cites other Divrei Chazal which dispute it. So that even the license that the Ramban is seemingly projecting here is one which is qualified possibly Toch Kedei Dibur in two different ways. Moreover, if you look at the rest of the Vikuach, it's very striking, as again, many people have noted, this is not my Kiddush, that, you know, numerous other challenges like this, you know, come up, you know, Divrei Chazal, Divrei Medrash, in this exchange, and the Ramban never returns, you know, to this first suggestion of rejecting the authority of the Medrash. His posture in the rest of the Vikuach is to, you know, dispute the interpretation, you know, either on the pshat level or, again, in light of contradictory midrashic texts, you know, to propose a different solution and a different suggestion. So, as I said, there's a big controversy. Did the Ramban mean this or not? Like some of the historians, some of the famous Jewish Spanish historians, Cecil Roth, and if you know these names, I don't know how passé they are, but, you know, Yitzchak Bear, otherwise known as Fritz Bear. Personally, I used to call him Fritz. No. But, so they were very, and of course many Talmid Chachamim, you know, throughout have suggested that, you know, the Ramban didn't really mean this, that it's inconsistent with his broader view. The fact that he didn't follow up, you know, with this is an indication of that as well, of his discomfort. But he did write it, and the point is that he, you know, was feeling a tremendous amount of pressure. He was basically, you know, under the glare of, you know, publicity, and, you know, was being challenged, you know, from within on a matter of deep theology and critical theology. And, you know, you know, rather than allow Jewish texts, you know, to be used to prove, you know, the messianic validity of the Christian perspective of deity, the Ramban took an uncharacteristic view. Others, Professor Shaul Lieberman and others, you know, really thought that the Ramban wouldn't have said it if he didn't mean it, and that kind of it's the outer limit of what he said. Some of them tried to explain that it really isn't so radically different than what we found, you know, earlier, you know, in some of the Gaonim, you know, again in the Kuzari, you know, in the Rambam, etc. Although it is a little bit different, and it is a stronger, definitely a stronger formulation. You know, interestingly enough, part of the controversy is not just to figure out what the Ramban meant, but what impact, you know, his strong assertion of the, you know, non-binding nature of Medrash in this context, or that you could just, you know, reject it, or that it was wrong, etc., what impact did that have going forward on the erosion of, you know, both belief and especially halachic observance, you know, in Spain, you know, going forward. The community of Spain's religiosity really deteriorated under persecution and other things, Christian Spain. And moreover, the impact that kind of this open door had on undermining attitudes towards Jewish texts even beyond that. So that, for example, the Abarbanel in his discussion of Mashiach, you know, Yeshua's Mashicho, is very critical of the Ramban and really suggests that, you know, the Ramban kind of opened up a Pandora's box. You know, once you say that the Midrashic parts, you know, of the Talmud, you know, are subject to being, you know, rejected as not just, oh, we don't understand them, or there's a machlokas, but, you know, this doesn't make any sense, and therefore it's, you know, wrong, and we're not even bound to explain it. Once you open, you know, that avenue, it becomes very difficult to say, well, but the memra next door to it, you know, which is a halachic memra, which is what the Ramban says explicitly, right? That when it comes to the Perush HaMitzvos in the Talmud, you know, that there's nothing to dispute or to debate. I mean, the Ramban's view on that distinction is, no matter what you think about his view in Medrash, is completely unequivocal. But the Abarbanel and others basically were arguing that you know, not so easy for people, you know, to distinguish or to discriminate, you know, on the same page, you know, when talking about the same authorities as well. Yeah.
The Abarbanel is making a procedural point that it's just like it's a bad policy to institute that. People can reject
the judgment
whenever they want, or he's making that as a substantive point that there's no distinction.
He put it this way: his comments, you know, it's not so clear, but his comments are very critical. What he is saying is that once the Ramban made the comments that he did, it willy nilly had the impact of eroding other things. I'll look again at the word. Is it so much? And there, that, I think it's a comment. It's his take. It's his assessment, you know, of what emerged from this. Is that, and therefore, you know, even if you think this to be true, you know, this is not a wise thing to disclose, or you have to disclose it in such a fashion, you know, that the, you know, degree you know, clarity is even greater, or is it that therefore this can't be? I'll look at it again. I'm not 100% sure.
What would be the justification in the first place
of
dismissing Amari Chazal that are agadic?
Well, I'm saying I think no serious authority dismisses Amari Chazal, you know, for the sport of it, you know,
for serious reasons.
Yeah, so there has to be some counter-pressure. So what I was trying to say was that historically, earlier, that counter-pressure was, well, it runs objectively. Forget about any kind of, you know, it being invoked in a way. We'll get to that in a second. But just objectively, it runs afoul of proper deos. I mean, this is something that I want to read the Rambam's three groups in his Akdamah Dechelik, because I think it's important for that. I mean, the Rambam will tell you that the first group, as he calls them, meaning the people who read Medrash literally and simply, they deserve, you know, to be admired for their emuna in one respect, meaning their simple faith and their commitment and their loyalty, and the Rambam actually admires that very much. But, you know, in the end of the day, he thinks that, you know, it's not just like they're cute, they're sweet, you know, and they're innocuous. He thinks that there's, you know, significant damage that emerges from this in terms of the authenticity of certain doctrines in Torah. In other words, if in the end of the day, a more anthropomorphic conception or materialistic conception of God, you know, emerges from reading Medrash, you know, in a literal way, then it's not just, you know, you don't have to, but you could. You know, it ends up being something that erodes, you know, proper opinions. So I guess that's one model. One model would be if, you know, it's one counterpressure would be that, you know, a literal reading is theologically or philosophically or, you know, value, Weltanschauung, you know, oriented, you know, problematic. Or that it contradicts some other or bigger, more authoritative, based on consensus or where it comes from, doctrine. I'm sorry?
There's no such thing as like an improper day of like halacha?
What do you mean an improper day of halacha?
I mean, the assumption here is that an improper day in some sort of hashgafic area.
No, because halacha is halacha. That certainly, because that's the nature of what halacha is. Halacha is the system of law that is sanctioned. It's understood to begin with that, you know, that agada, according to these authorities, and there are many of them, you know, doesn't, is more, you know, that it's it doesn't have the same rigor as halacha. It's not binding. It's a take of great men on, you know, these values. But it isn't, because it isn't a norm and it isn't rooted in a norm, so the whole rigor and the source of authority and all of that is in a different level completely. And that's why the Ramban was very clear about that. The comment of the Barbanel and others who were critical of the Ramban was not chas v'shalom that the Ramban, you know, was fudging these distinctions, but that, you know, even if it's true, you know, it's hard for people who are receiving all this to be as discriminating. But the world of halacha is the world of, you know, Dalet Amos Shel Halacha is sacrosanct. Again, you know, how we interpret it and what those values are, you know, that sometimes we don't know there are chukim, there are, or that you need cumulative evidence, or there can be different takes on that. That's kind of what we're doing every day. And sometimes that can be, you know, important in a particular society to understand things. But no, this is a very important distinction. So that's one counterpressure. The counterpressure of the doctrine being understood as is, you know, literally, or when it contradicts other ones, you know, being a problem. The second one is the one that we've been discussing now, and that is when, you know, for historical reasons, maybe there's nothing intrinsically wrong with the, with, you know, with the Divrei Chazal in question, but let's say that theologically. The second part, before I get to that the historical question and how it's used, is the question of the accuracy itself. In other words, we're interested in what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai or Rabbi Yoshua or Rava or Abaya or whoever it is, you know, to know what they say and their, to share their wisdom on anything is something that we embrace, you know, very enthusiastically. So as such, you know, it's not only the counterpressure, let's say, of eroding, like, basic belief. We really want to know what they mean. So if you take it literally and it's not intended literally, if you assume that, then, you know, it's, again, it's very nice in terms of, as a show of loyalty, but it doesn't get us closer to the idea of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai or Rava or Abaya, etc. And I think that's a factor, too. The third one is the one that we're kind of discussing now, and that is that, you know, what happens when cynical, you know, people invoke, you know, texts, revered texts, you know, in a cynical way, meaning they try to turn it against, you know, the religious establishment. So vikuchim are a great example. Now there can be internal vikuchim. You know, there were, you know, in the 19th century and the advent of reform, you know, and since, and then the, you know, little battles that we have even up to our own day. You know, sometimes people can do that. So there are many l'shem shamayim parts of those struggles, and sometimes there's a little bit of a cynical element where, you know, you take a text, you take it out of context, or I got you on this one. You know, attitudes towards non-Jews, attitudes towards, women, attitudes towards some other factor, you know, that's, you know, very, you know, politically, you know, explosive. So the question is, what do you do with that? So that's a third case. Maybe intrinsically, you know, if there weren't these other agendas, you know, there wouldn't be an issue, it wouldn't be a problem. But in the climate that there is, so what do you do when people are, you know, cynically, like, you know, undermining, you know, the what the texts really intend in a broad sense to accomplish with the texts themselves? So having the latitude of saying, you know, these texts are, or putting in context that they're not halacha, you know, that they're, you know, not mishpat echad yelachem, that they're not necessarily literal, and in some cases maybe they're not binding at all, you know, becomes an important tactic. So again, it's hard to know in the Ramban. I have to, you know, consult with Itamar on the latest, you know, Ramban literature and his own. But my view is that, you know, there's probably something, you know, in between, the extremes. It's I think unacceptable to believe that the Ramban would quote something that he totally doesn't believe. And I don't think that and if he didn't have the view that the Gaonim and others, the Rambam and others, had even had a more liberal, let's say, perspective on how to interpret these texts and the nature of their often authority and so on and so forth. If he didn't believe that was legitimate, I think that he probably couldn't have articulated what he did. He probably was uncomfortable with what he articulated, or the force of it, but and was unquestionably under huge pressure in that he felt that this was cynically being invoked in a way that was not being Mekadesh Shem Shemayim, obviously. What I'm saying is that he for sure was probably personally more comfortable with the default view, not only of reverence but of authority. Also agreed that the other view was within Elu Ve'elu Divre Elokim Chayim parameters, and that in some cases, of course, you don't interpret literally. We know that he himself, integrates Medrash very compellingly, but also understands that there are different views. So I think that he might have spoken more forcefully than reflects his general posture, but was able to do that because underlying what he did say, or underpinning what he did say, was a greater flexibility in his understanding of the nature and character of Agada. But probably was there was a certain discomfort in the forceful way that he said it, which definitely was inspired by the urgency of the situation. So it wasn't false, and it also probably wasn't representative, and it probably did reveal some of the flexibility that is probably inherent in his general view as well. So that is how I see the position of the Ramban. But I think this question of the assessment of its impact within the Jewish community, whether it's the Abarbanel or others later, is, I think, a very critical chapter and something which, I think highlights, the dangers. Again, it could be the Ramban had no choice at the time, or maybe in retrospect, even, opening up a little more than he was comfortable, but, with the possible implications, maybe it was a historical error. Notwithstanding the L'shem Shemayim, I'm not critical of the Ramban, but in retrospect, it's something really to think about. Anyways, I took much too much time. That's regarding the position of the Ramban. What I want to still do is discuss, the Rambam and some of the language that the Rambam uses, in his three categories, and then we'll move on to some of the Gemaras in the beginning. Okay, good. So now back to Pshara. Good. So the